Hi, you are listening to a free Majority Report. If you would like to become a member, please go to majority.fm.
Yes,
oh, my name's Janine Garofalo. How are you?
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, March 21st, 2014. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Cliff Schechter on vacation somewhere lost in the middle of the Grand Canyon, I believe. So joining us today will be Guy Lawson, author of a multitude of best-selling books and contributing writer to Rolling Stone. Also on the program to provide with me a movie recommendation for which I will not have the opportunity to watch over the weekend. Both my kids are sick now. Will be Michael Ian Black, comedian, raconteur, author. Author, raconteur. Also on today's program, Alan Simpson speaks. Oh my God. This guy. I tell you, I read an interview with him that Josh Idelson did, and it sounded like a half a click away from Fred Phelps. Just a crazy old man.
He's a crazy old man, but he has a certain cavalier attitude that in some ways he taps into a stream of youthful apathy way more than those Republican millennials.
That's true.
It's kind of amazing.
Former Obama economic advisor with a new report on the long-term unemployed. He says his one regret is we didn't do more to prevent the long-term unemployed. Also on the program today, Bill Donahue of the Catholic League. You remember that guy. He's going to be fabulous soon. And we will get to that story about Bernie Madoff, of course. The plane and more sanctions on Russia. Russia responds with their own sanctions. And frankly, I think largely a lot of this is a lot of theater, frankly. Not dealing with sort of the main levers behind it, which I think, frankly, is just carbon-based energy. But we will talk more on that as the program progresses. Also, these stories I've been talking about from this week on the relentless amounts of money spent by charter supporters in New York State. We are having a huge battle here between our mayor and our governor and around charters, among other things. There were actually people arrested protesting Governor Cuomo in the Capitol yesterday. Cuomo the Lesser. Hat tip Kevin Baker. And just for simply being so relentlessly bad on so many issues that are important to not just Democratic constituencies. I mean, because it is interesting. You're a big Democratic donor in New York State. A guy named Samuels came out and said this guy Cuomo should just run as a Republican. There are both partisan Democratic complaints, But a lot of that stems from policy decisions that Cuomo has followed, but also political decisions, like not campaigning for Democrats, like almost campaigning against a Democratic takeover of the state Senate. Things like appointing Pataki to a tax advisory committee, which will punish poor communities in terms of their property taxes. I mean, and the list goes on and on. Charters, one of them. Public employees, another. Unions, another. Massive tax breaks for corporations, another. It goes on and on. But it's just, you don't see people going out and getting arrested, protesting just generally, we don't like this guy. We will talk more about that as the show progresses. But first, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Guy Lawson will join us. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome friend of show, contributing writer for Rolling Stone, author of a multitude of books, the latest, of course, which was Octopus, Guy Lawson. And Guy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam.
Michael said he saw you on like a clip of CNBC talking about Sam Israel.
Oh yeah? They did a show called American Greed. And they did a documentary about Sam Israel and Bayou and the Ponzi scheme that I wrote a book about. And that's just, I guess, in high rotation. So
now when CNBC does a show called American Greed, is that, I imagine for them, it's either value neutral or actually promoting it.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Is that a tautology is what I wonder.
So, all right. So let's talk a little bit. I want to go through this interview with Madoff because it made me think of you, obviously, because you had written this book on Sam Israel, one of the other more celebrated, maybe, or I think renowned hedge fund Ponzi schemers.
Yeah.
But let's first talk about your thoughts on what's going on in terms of Russia, because I know that you have, you're as well-traveled and reporting all around the world, more so probably than anybody I know.
Well, thanks, Sam. You know, I'm finishing a book. I don't know, some of your listeners might recall that I was working on a book that relates to a couple of stoner arms dealers from Miami Beach who won a $300 million contract to supply all the ammunition to the Afghan National Army in 2007-2008. And so the book is written, and I'm just going through the edits. It'll be coming out, I think, early next year from Simon & Schuster. But literally this week I've been going through this particular part of the book that just seems so relevant to today, and I'll try to make this brief. But in short, in 2006,
don't make it brief, buddy.
Let's hear it all. In 2006, the Bush administration was facing two losing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The decision was made to surge thousands of troops into Iraq. This left Afghanistan in the lurch, as Barack Obama was pointing out on the campaign trail at that time. So they were facing the strategic catastrophe in Afghanistan. And so the decision was made by the Bush administration and Donald Rumsfeld and all Dick Cheney and all those people that you, I'm sure your listeners miss so much, to recalibrate the strategy of standing up, as they say, the Afghan National Army. And the first and foremost part of that was to get them ammunition. And so in order to get them ammunition, they needed to buy up basically hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Russian-style ammo because the Afghans had Russian-style weapons. So this has never been reported anywhere, but this is except in my book. And about the Sam Seder Majority Report exclusive here.
Hold on for a second.
Sure.
Okay, that's the breaking news.
Right? Is that the smart strategic thing to do would be to buy the ammunition from the Russians. There's a company called Rosoboron, which is one of these, you know, oligarchical companies that is the world's biggest manufacturer of ammunition.
Mm.
And so it was reported in the British press, but never in the United States press for reasons that I, you know, the readers of the book will have to see. But I think in essence, point to the laziness and the kind of just the poor reporting of the Pentagon press corps. In any event, it was reported in the British press that the United States had approached this Russian arms company to buy, for example, 100 million rounds of AK-47, millions of, you know, grenades and howitzer rounds and mortar shells, everything you need to build an army. Right? So this is like this strategic masterstroke. The Russians who lost in Afghanistan are going to help the Americans who are losing in Afghanistan to triumph by giving them new, serious, high-quality weapons.
Right.
Okay. 6 weeks later, the Russians enter into a contract with the Iranians to service their fighter pilots, their fighter jets. This causes the United States to impose sanctions on Russia. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that sound familiar?
Uh-huh.
So that now the United States forbids itself from buying ammunition from Russia. Okay? That still leaves one obvious place to buy this massive amount of ammunition, China. But China also has relations with Iran. Nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, nothing to do with atomic weaponry or this whole, you know, all the stuff that the sanctions are supposed to be about, but just basic military-to-military relations. So they banned China as well, okay? So the two primary sources for what you need most desperately in Afghanistan, you can't go there anymore. So guess who gets the responsibility for fulfilling this strategic contract, which is two stoners from Miami Beach who win the contract online by bidding the lowest amount of money.
Of course. If you cannot get that weapons that you need from Russia or from China, the next obvious place is to find two guys with a huge hookah in an apartment in Miami Beach who have an internet connection, and you buy it from them. What other option do you have?
This is why Donald Rumsfeld was such an amazing CEO, and Dick Cheney, they know how to run large, complicated organizations straight into the brick wall. I mean, it's so... You know, when I look at Russia now, what I see, I mean, to add a little texture to that moment, you know, Russia said at the time, Putin said, we consider this ban on us in the international arms market as an act of war. And Putin was also responding to the expansion of NATO and considering that aggressive and belligerent. China, likewise, was being reprimanded for increases in defense spending by Rumsfeld and the neocons at that time in 2006, after the election of 2004 and 2005, were just, you know, talking about gearing up for the next great war with China.
Right.
So, you know, what you have is this, you know, an inability in this country, it seems to me, to pause and see the consequences of your own behavior and equally to wonder why it is that people or nations behave the way they do. Is Vladimir Putin just like a psychopath? Is that the new narrative here? Or is this the result of many years, post-Cold War, strategic humiliation, belligerence, punitive measures, and just basically bullying? And, you know, and so I don't think this excuses Putin in the slightest, and I don't think that this, but it does something for for understanding the situation. I mean, everyone's talking about these Hitler analogies. Well, think about, you know, Germany between the wars and how Germany was treated, you know, humiliated, the Deutschmark just run down to the ground. You know, like, is that really like the 21st century model for how to solve problems through humiliation and sanctions? I mean, is Barack Obama, is that the sum total of his geopolitical wisdom? It's just, it's kind of abject.
Well, you know, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, my sense is that this sort of, much of this sort of back and forth just seems to be more for sort of like the domestic politics, I guess, of both countries in some way. Like, look.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine before coming on, Sam. I wanted to do my homework, and there's a good buddy of mine who's runs a hedge fund, to talk about hedge funds, that it invests heavily into Russia and the Baltic and that region. And, you know, he feels like it's going to get worse rather than better. And so he's really moving out of that. He's cashing out, taking his losses and just moving, you know, like moving to cash for you investors out there. But what he said to me today, which I thought was really interesting, is that this is for domestic politics. But really what they're now fighting about is Russia's ongoing efforts to destabilize the Ukraine. And so the Crimean thing is finished. It's done. That's not going to be changed. But now, really, the fight is over whether Ukraine's going to have a chance to sort of determine its own future, or whether Putin's going to, over the long term, slowly, slowly just eat at its stability by various nefarious means.
But, I mean, what is the end game for Putin there? Is there just so much resources, and he thinks that at one point that Russia could absorb the rest of Ukraine?
You know, I think that the basic premise of international relations is that people act logically. But then, you know, just look at Iraq. You know, what the hell was that about? You know, it was about pride and Bush's father and revenge. I mean, I think that Putin is surrounded by enough people with enough at stake that he's going to, at the end of the day, you know, make a decision that's sensible and doesn't escalate things yet further. But, you know, the guy is proud of himself. You see him in all these photos with his shirt off, and you know he does his karate, his martial arts. You know, people are people,
right?
And they act from emotion, and so, you know, I think that that's one of the foolhardy things about this moment is that the knee jerk response is to you know, sort of demonize him. I think, you know, if there's some way, without being, you know, cowardly about it, or without being you know, defending the interests of the West, to find like a middle ground here and to allow the Ukraine to have its own future, that's the way to go. But I mean, you know, maybe that's just Pollyanna-ish of me. But
well, I'm just not even sure what necessarily what large, strategic interest the United States has in Crimea. I mean, my sense is very little, but much more so perhaps in terms of the broader Ukraine, because of its relationship with Europe, but with the EU, and but that to me seems like, you know, the EU seems to be paralyzed because of their dependency on Ukrainian oil and energy.
And I think also because of genuine ambivalence, you know. But, you know, I, my friend, the hedge fund guy, makes the point, and I think it's a smart one, is that, you know, the premise of a peaceful Europe is that you don't change borders through force. You know, that's been the order from post-Second World War. So this is a really pretty dangerous, you know, step by Putin. And I don't want your listeners to think that I'm minimizing that. I think that it's also a moment for the United States to sort of to take a moment to look at the kind of order that it's this new world order that's trying to create, and what the consequences are. You know, this is a great civilization, the Slavic civilization. You don't just slap it around.
Right. And I think to a certain extent too, you know, you've got Ukraine wants to be part of Europe, and Russia wants Ukraine to be more aligned, I think, with Russia, or more within their sphere of influence. So there, you know, obviously what you got to do is give something in terms of Russia that will at the very least make that transition where Ukraine becomes more identified or allied or in the sphere of influence with Europe, that will make that transition easier, I guess.
I mean, you got to sweeten the pot. I don't know, but you know, there's an old Chinese curse. They say, "May you live in interesting times."
Yeah.
I'm afraid we do.
Yeah, well, I hope it doesn't get that much more interesting in that part of the world, frankly. But,
no kidding.
But wait, let me ask you. We got a question from someone who's hit us on Twitter. And
yeah.
I should say at this point, Guy Lawson 2, right, is your Twitter handle?
Yeah, I don't use Twitter. I Facebook is where I post daily.
Really? All right. Well, we're going to put a link to the Facebook page. Let's get
last
the
time, I mean, I never
likes.
Get... This you're a like machine as far as I'm.
Well, we'll talk in a few as to how I said to Guy, like, you got to get more on Facebook, dude. And kicking and screaming. But why didn't the U.S. opt to supply the Afghanis with Western weapons? I mean, I know this just from talking.
Not Western,
to you.
Eastern.
No, but the.
Oh, now you mean?
No, at that time. Why didn't they just simply say, we're going to supply the Afghanis with Western weapons?
Oh, I see. Yeah. The answer to that is primarily this. It costs $105,000 to train and equip an American soldier. It cost, at that time, it cost about $2,000 to train and equip an Iraqi soldier. It cost $180 to train and equip an Afghan soldier.
Mm.
So really, money. I mean, it was like an amazing trick to simultaneously squander billions and shortchange
right.
the same war. It's like, wow, how did you do that?
And just recap, I mean, obviously, we've talked about this story, but where did those two stoners get their the weapons?
The place you would naturally go if you were trying to solve your problems, Albania,
right.
Of course.
Well, of course.
Right? Yeah, because, what happened in Albania is that, I would like your listeners to please sit down and be prepared for a big shock. There was corruption.
In Albania?
Yeah, can you believe it? And it involves gangsters, ancient Chinese ammunition, repacking, federal indictments, conspiracy by federal prosecutors and courts to hide all the evidence of American complicity. And basically, what the United States government did in 2006, and even before then in Iraq, was set itself up as the world's biggest gun-running organization. They essentially did a circumvented the existing legal system that the State Department had to ensure that the government doesn't do business with illegal arms dealers. They created a sort of a parallel system, a covert system, and then that's where the dudes sort of went into this world, and one of them's in federal prison, and the others were all convicted of federal fraud. I mean, when you get into the business of dirty work with the American government, you're just always going to lose.
Right. I mean, essentially, the U.S. government wanted to circumvent their own embargo.
Correct. And you know what? Even better than that, they sent their own law enforcement agency out after themselves.
And but they got the right guys insofar as they didn't get the right guys.
Well, you know, that there's something perverse about this, too. And this involves like how the story was reported and to some extent, I did a story in Rolling Stone about it, and then the book is called Arms and the Dudes, which is, of course, a reference to Virgil's Of Arms and the Men I Sing and George Bernard Shaw's play Arms and the Men. This is, I think we live in the age of Arms and...
Of course, I knew that.
Yeah. We live in the age of Arms and the Dudes, I think. The thing of it was is that these kids, look, they were wake-and-bake stoners. They were... one of them had a ninth grade education. The other was a licensed masseuse. But you know what else they were? Really, really smart.
Right.
And they were actually really good at what they did. Yeah. And the American government was saving millions of dollars using them. So there's like the ironies, you know, sort of, it's like, you know, whipped cream with sprinkles and a cherry and then a little bit more sprinkles. It's a very sort of strange concoction that I hope, you know, people will pick up and read and see.
Oh, my God. I can't wait for that book to come out.
You know what? I've been thinking about it, Sam. Thanks, man. You know, I've been thinking about it. It's like this book is really, because I'm reading it carefully now, editing it again. It's such a case study in failure. like how failure really operates. People don't set out to fail. You know, Donald Rumsfeld didn't want to lose in Afghanistan. It's like, but you don't examine your maybe this is to circle it back to Russia. You don't examine what your motives are. You don't examine, you know, am I making the right decisions here? What are the consequences? How do I think it through? And I think that applies to our lives as much as anything else. I feel like this has made me a lot more kind of self-aware of how I move through my days, you know, like trying to think things through.
Interesting. That's fascinating. I'm so excited for that book. And I think, you know,
the movie, dude.
What's that? Is there a movie too?
It's Todd Phillips, the Hangover guy, owns the movie rights. And Jonah Hill's attached to act in it. And I think that they're thinking about, you know, starting it sometime soon. But I'm the last to know, of course.
Right. Well, just FYI, available.
Yeah, I think your daughter would be fabulous in it.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
But no, we can put Saul.
Well, my one-year-old. Well, we could talk. Is there a role for a baby in that?
Like the Todd Phillips movie. It's got to be, right?
Let's talk about, because I don't want to run out of time here. I want to talk about this Bernie Madoff thing, because your last book was about Sam Israel, who was also an amazing story of massive failure in some respects. Really catastrophic. And we've talked about the book here, but it's basically about a guy who didn't set out to defraud and basically defraud people of millions upon millions of dollars. And during the course of him attempting to dig himself out of this hole with this fraudulent hedge fund, he himself became defrauded. And it's just a bizarre, just an unbelievable story. Madoff is in prison now, gave one of, I guess, only his like third or fourth interview.
Right.
And this guy, as opposed to Sam Israel, this guy really seems to have walled off like what he did. This guy seems to be really out of touch.
Yeah. The point of differentiation between Sam Israel and Bernard Madoff, I think, is just like is epic. And the difference is that, you know, Sam inhabited his fraud, its consequences, and its aftermath as a human being. He's recognizably human. You know, I mean, I'm in touch with him regularly now. And, you know, he goes through the things that you would think you would go through, including, you know, huge amounts of remorse, you know, and lots of kinds of, you know, feeling lost in the world and, you know, all this. If you got 22 years in prison, how would you feel?
Right.
I think that the thing that they had in common, one of the big things, is that they couldn't accept failure. They couldn't admit to their failure. And they both, neither started their funds to commit frauds, but both, when confronted with losses and the reality of having to face failure, they couldn't do it. But the thing about, you know, Madoff that comes across in this article as well is that he's really pretty sociopathic, man.
Right.
He's like there's really not a lot of feeling to the guy. A lot of, you know, and talk about not learning your lessons. But the other thing that I thought in reading that interview that really came out to me was, both Sam and Madoff say the same thing, and so I'm just going to take them at their word. They both say, there are lots more like me out there you haven't caught yet.
Right.
And, you know, to me, that really rings true. That's like, of course.
Yeah, Madoff said the one piece of investment advice I would give you would be not to invest your money on the stock market.
Yeah, you know, I've been asked to give a talk to the to a meeting of a $50 billion hedge fund in the fall, that is something like what Sam, you know, other commonalities between Israel and Madoff. They knew each other slightly. Sam met them once. They're both in the same prison facility now.
Oh, really?
Madoff's in the sort of hospital side, and Sam's in the general population. Sam tells me that people there typically don't like Madoff, and I can tell you that Sam is a pretty popular guy because he's still a cut up and, you know, just the same guy he was. Anyway, what the hell is it going to say? They both came up with the same performance, rate of performance, which is 18% per year. You know, independently, just like that's the magic number. So anybody out there that's thinking about running a Ponzi scheme, 18% is the return you want to offer.
That's
people.
The one that people will believe, but also will definitely be attracted. It's a good
time
to remind
people. It's so unbelievable that it's believable.
You get an 18% benefit when you become a Majority Report member. it actually increases the value of your money by 18% in some fashion.
Yeah. So I'm speaking to this hedge fund in September, I guess. I'm thinking about this only happened this week. I'm thinking about maybe just making it all like an instruction manual for how to run a Ponzi scheme. Because I mean, who knows if they are or aren't? Maybe they want me there to help them avoid getting caught.
Right. That's exactly what you would do too if you were running a Ponzi scheme. You invite a guy who has investigated Ponzi schemes.
That's right.
And it gives you perfect cover. Like, why would we ever have a guy to talk about Ponzi schemes if we were actually running a Ponzi scheme?
Nothing to look at here. Move along.
I love Madoff talking about his politics. He's when he's asked about Bill de Blasio, he says, "I'm not a great fan of redistribution of wealth."
Except in his direction.
Yeah, exactly. Unless it's coming to me. He's pissed at Obama. He voted for Obama in 2008, but he says he's terribly disappointed and would not have voted for him a second time. Except for the fact that he was in prison, because his policies are too socialist.
I was really interested in his who he picked as his favorite.
Yes.
He's actually someone I admire kind of quite a bit.
Yeah, he was asked who his favorite politician was, and he said Ron Wyden from Oregon.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing I can imagine is at one point Wyden had signed on to a fairly sort of like neoliberal market-based Medicare plan at one point, which he...
And dereg in the late 90s. Remember under, you know, that whole, like, that moment of, like, when they got rid of Glass-Steagall on the sly?
Yeah. And I think that's probably it on some level. He said he was asked if he's changed as a person, and he said, "There's nothing for me to change from. It's not like I ever considered myself a bad person. I made a horrible mistake. I'm sorry."
Yeah. Yeah. That. And the judge, you know, and then he complains about his sentence, but there's a deeper irony here to this. You know, the judge explicitly said, "I'm giving him 150 years to help his victims heal and get over their pain," right? Mm. So let's use the penal system for some theoretical, you know, solving the wounds of victims. I mean, it's so far removed from any kind of idea of what prisons once were hoped to be, you know, hoped to do.
Right. I mean, this is like, why not just chop his hand off or something?
Yeah.
That would also...
Pure revenge. I mean, Sam Israel's doing 20. What? He's not harming anybody again. This is just pure vindictiveness. You know, white-collar criminals are always going to exist, but is the solution 20 years?
Well, the funny thing is that he makes a point of saying, like, at one point in the interview about how none of the heads of, here he is. He says, "Look, my crime was a failing of the oversight of the industry, but I can't really blame the SEC or regulators for that. The government
never have the resources.
Yeah, the government never gives them enough money to police the industry, whether it's someone like me or insider trading." And he said another problem was the government's failure to jail individual bankers following the financial crisis.
Yeah, so you've got Bernard Madoff bemoaning the lack of prosecutions of J.P. Morgan Chase.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I don't know where you go to get that in the museum of irony.
I mean, it's stunning. And, you know, frankly, he's got a point. I mean, on some level,
of course he does.
He was sort of the bone that was thrown to the country, you know, that at least there's somebody who's paying the price, who's remotely related to this industry that caused such incredible hardship for millions upon millions upon millions of Americans.
Yeah, so, you know, there's nobody that understands the, and I'll use a little potty word here, is that okay?
Sure.
The baloney, the BS of Wall Street more than Wall Streeters. And that, you know, this is part of the explanation for Sam Israel. So just to remind folks, he was running a $450 million hedge fund that was a Ponzi scheme, and he had $150 million in cash, and he was desperate to solve his situation, so he tried to trade out of it. And this was when he fell in with a guy who claimed to be a CIA operative with access to a secret market that the Fed runs in London. It's called, it's this high-yield investment. So Sam wired $150 million bucks to London and proceeded to try to trade these mystical bonds. It was a fraud. But the interesting thing to me about it is that, and this is what Matt Taibbi noted when his review of the book, is that, you know, of course a Wall Street guy would fall for that because he sees all the fraud around him all day, every day.
Right. Why wouldn't there? Of course
there's a bigger fraud. Of course.
Right. Why wouldn't there be a secret bond market that only the elites had access to when he sees what the elites are doing all around him?
And this is Madoff saying, of course J.P. Morgan's chasing and there's other funds like me,
yep,
and insider trading's epidemic. Of course.
I have to point out, too, that only a Canadian would say, I'm going to use some potty language, and then say baloney.
There you go. What would you think I was going to say?
I don't know. What, potty baloney's pretty tame around here.
Couple of hosers. Well, you got a hoser on the line here.
All right. Well, Guy, as always, a pleasure. We got to get together soon. And
awesome.
Folks, go over to Facebook. Obviously, it's you look up Guy Lawson on Facebook. We have a link at Majority FM. And give Guy some likes. It'll make his day,
man.
Folks. The life of a writer, just sequestered in your little writing hovel that you have.
I've taken an office in the village.
Oh, you have?
I won't say the village, but I'm too much out in the countryside. So, yeah, but I try to post something pretty much every day for, you know, interesting reads. I have one up now from Texas Monthly about a murder case from the 80s. So I'm enjoying doing the Facebook stuff, and I'd love to have anybody who wants to check it out to do
so. All right. Guy Lawson, everybody. Guy, thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Sam. Take care, man.
Okay. All right, Bye. Folks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will get a movie recommendation and catch up with my old acquaintance. Sort of a buddy. Yeah, but my old buddy, Michael Ian Black. Also, he's been on the program a couple of times. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program comedian, author, actor, writer, podcast host, other things, father, husband, Michael Ian Black. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be here. You forgot aviation expert.
I had no idea. Well, do tell. Where's the plane?
Yeah. What I think people, you know the Occam's razor, of course. If there are competing theories, choose the simplest one. And to me, the simplest theory is that there never was a plane and that this entire thing is a false flag operation.
By CNN.
Clearly, it's by CNN. I don't think it's a coincidence that Jeb Zucker came in. He had a mandate. That mandate was to generate ratings. His first efforts failed. We've seen the controversy with Piers Morgan. Now Anderson Cooper is getting the boot in the pooper. And
wait a second, is Anderson Cooper getting fired?
I think he's losing the 360, right? That got canceled.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow, breaking news.
Not so much.
Okay.
But something had to be done. When do people watch CNN? In times of crisis, when they want up-to-the-minute news and updates on stories that captivate the world? What better way to do that than the story of a missing airliner? Hence, an airliner from a country nobody's ever heard of goes missing.
Malaysia's not totally unheard of, but okay.
Well,
I mean, you're an aviation expert. I don't want to argue that point with you because you probably had no...
In aviation circles, we almost never talk about Malaysia.
Fair enough. And, I mean, this is the only thing that makes sense and probably will happen. This thing will die down after another week or two. And then who knows what... my guess is probably right now Jeff Zucker is looking for a small white girl to throw down a well or something.
Of course. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, follow the money. That's what I guess I'm saying. Follow the money. Who profits? Jeff Zucker profits. CNN ratings have been through the roof since this occurred. CNN's coverage, as you know, has been blanket. It's been nonstop. And, yeah, Zucker created this false flag operation of a missing, quote-unquote, Malaysian airline filled with, quote-unquote, Malaysian and Chinese nationals. We still don't know who was, quote-unquote, on the plane because they haven't released the names. And this is a hallmark of the Zucker false flag operation playbook. Release information in drips and drabs, spread it out as long as humanly possible, and yeah, I mean, it ties together very, very neatly.
This is, you know, it's the first time I've heard this. In fact, this is the only theory that I have not heard floated on CNN, which in and of itself is an indictment.
Of course, I've been shouting this theory from the rooftop from moment one. And has any news source besides you picked it up? No, because it doesn't only indict CNN, Sam. It indicts the entire lamestream media. Because if Zucker can do it, guess who else can do it? Ailes can do it. Murdoch can do it. Gore can do it.
Griffin.
All these titans. Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is a good point. I mean, it's huge. I mean, we think about it. On CNN, they have now covered like psychics, black holes, God, the potential for it being a TV show.
Yes, Langoliers, everything.
Everything, except for the fact that none of it ever existed.
Except,
it's completely made up.
Except for the simplest explanation of all. And that should tell you something.
Wow.
There never was a plane.
You've just blown the minds of a lot of people who tuned in, just if only from the fact that you're an aviation expert. I don't think people knew that about you.
Well, it's not the kind of credential that I wave around like some of these other so-called aviation experts, you know, like this Sully guy going around saying I'm an aviation expert, because those other things about me are also true. I want to be seen as a complete person, not just as an aviation expert. You know, I'm a multifaceted human being.
Let's get on to that, because we've been digging around. We did a little research. You're doing duck quacks don't echo? What is that?
That's the science show for Nat Geo. Again, it plays into my aviation expertness. And it's a sort of comedy science show for the National Geographic Channel, in which we examine various scientific theories in a comedic way. And it's educational,
actually...
it's education and it's infotainment.
And wait a second. I just, we dug up your IMDb thing. Did you get that Gaffigan pilot?
I did do the Jim Gaffigan pilot, yes.
Didn't I see you there at that audition?
Yeah, that's right. I did see you there.
Holy cow.
That's the last time I saw you.
That's the last time I saw you. Was at that audition. That's was
right.
I walked out of there going like I'm not rough enough to do this. And then you get it. They went.
But I don't. I think I got a different part than you auditioned for.
Oh, all right. Well,
I got the part of the aviation expert.
Ah. How was that? Was that fun? Was the show fun?
It was really fun. Yeah, it was really fun. Jim Gaffigan, as your listeners know, is a tremendously talented, funny man, and
he's got so many
kids. Shot the pilot, and I have no hopes of it going to series.
Right, of course. That's what it's all about, right?
Right.
It's
about not emotionally investing in anything that you do.
And that, I mean, you're right now, you're on family vacation, too. Is it, is that, you carry that over into your private life?
Not getting emotionally invested. Yeah, I can't separate the personal from the professional because my work is my art. My art is my work. My life and art are intertwined so fully that, yeah, I haven't emotionally committed to my marriage of 15 years. And by extension, I have not emotionally committed yet to my children.
And how old are those kids? Your kids are like 10 now.
Right? I don't know. Yeah. I have no idea.
I love that. I
one of them is walking by right now. How old are you? She's counting. She doesn't know. 10. 10, she said.
She's got to count. Wow. She's. Are you sending those kids to school or no? You're just doing the just not even the homeschool.
No. You think I'm going to send them to public schools?
No.
Do you
no.
really think I'm going to send them to public schools? No.
No,
they're homeschooled.
They're
homeschooled in the traditional manner, which is to say with switches that they make themselves from branches that they find in the woods, and that's how we discipline them.
So tell me about your podcast, too. Are you doing a podcast with Showalter?
I'm doing a podcast with my longtime comedic compatriot, Michael Showalter, called Topics, in which he and I discuss the important topics, not only of the day, but of all days, of eternity. Mm. And we discuss them in as full and rich and informed way as we possibly can. In any given half hour, we try to cover 80% of any given topic. So if the topic, for example, is science, we try to cover 80% of science, at least 80% of science.
And you do it within 30 minutes. That's good. I mean, that's much more concise, I think, than a lot of shows would do it.
Well, there's a lot of filler in a lot of podcasts. I mean, your radio show, for example, I think is a great example of filler. And what we do is we eliminate the filler, we cut out the fat, and we just get to the muscle. And we're just exercising our brain muscles, and we ask the same of our listeners. This isn't an easy podcast. This isn't the kind of thing you come to if you want light entertainment. You come to this if you want to study and learn and get smart and find out about the world around you.
My understanding is that you even use like 30% of the words that a person uses typically in a sentence. You actually drop out just for to keep it that tight to the bone.
You have to. You have to. When you're as constrained, and you know the constraints that the internet places on you. I mean, you have to do things in half an hour or less. Otherwise, the costs just get exorbitant. So we have to do it in half an hour or less. Sometimes it's 40% of the words that we drop out. We have to.
Now, how do you guys do it? Isn't Showalter on the West Coast and you're on the East Coast?
That's right.
And so, what do you do?
And we do it with technology.
Mm.
We do it with incredible technology that I don't even think is commercially available.
That's stunning. And what did you do?
The same way that you're currently on the East Coast and I'm on the West Coast.
Are you on the West Coast right now?
I am. I'm in San Diego, California.
I had no idea. I mean, we would have done this in a much different. I can't believe that we're actually able to make this connection because usually we can only do the East Coast.
Well, because we're using the technology that I have access to, and I've opened Alice's Wonderland for you, and so now you're able to communicate with me over 300 miles away.
And so, what's next for Michael Ian Black?
Who knows, Sam?
Right.
I mean, one of the joys of my life is the opportunities never stop coming.
You know what? I mean, I know you're saying that. I know you're saying that, but it is true, though. You never stop working.
I do work a lot, but it's generally on garbage.
Right. Right. Well,
I do a lot of work on garbage. So I don't know. I mean, you know, I have, you know,
but that never seems to stick with you. I mean, only the stuff that you do that is good. I feel like, you know, people know about it. I mean, that's pretty good, actually.
That's the nice thing about garbage is it goes away and people forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, I may pursue the aviation expert route for a little while because I am starting to get some attention for that, and I like to be of service to people.
It's a where else are you getting attention? I mean, aside from this program, where else are you?
Nowhere.
Getting attention?
I mean, I think I very clearly said starting to get attention. It's starting with you.
All right. So you got to wait and see if you're going to get any momentum from this.
I'm pretty sure this is going to generate a lot, not only because of your literally tens of listeners, but because the theory is so provocative and makes so much sense that I think it's going to get picked up rather quickly.
Yeah, well, we're definitely going to push this out, because if it turns out that this is the case, I mean, obviously it's your theory, but we broke it here on the Majority Report.
Yeah, I can't thank you enough for giving me the opportunity for getting the message out, albeit in a very, very limited way.
Yes, well, I mean, every...
I do think it's important that people hear the message.
Every, you know, every journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first couple of steps, right? I mean...
Right, right. And this counts as maybe half of one of those first couple of steps, and so
right.
That's important. So thank you for giving me that opportunity.
Well, I mean, every journey starts with a half a step, technically... Like the smallest of fraction of step is the way is really.
That's right, Sam.
So
that's exactly right. You would be a great guest on Topics with this kind of insight.
Thank you. Now, as you know, Michael, I also have a family. I don't have the I don't care for them as well as you do. Therefore, I get a lot less license to go out of the house and
right.
and see a movie. So, as such, every Friday I like to get a movie recommendation. It could even be TV, but I prefer a movie on a streaming device. So I put it to you, Michael, what movie should I watch this weekend in the unlikely event that I'm allowed to actually have 2 hours to myself to watch a movie?
Well, this, Sam, is a film that I watched with my children once, and aside from a couple questionable moments, they enjoyed the heck out of it, and it's a film that I really think the whole family can sit around and have a great time with. And in light of the events of the previous week or 10 days or so, and in light of my aviation expert status, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a classic comedy called Airplane. Now, this satirical look at the aviation industry and the airplane or the disaster movie genre that was so popular in the 60s stars Julie Haggerty, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and a cast of all-stars satirizing aviation and jive talk.
And jive talk. And so what now, how questionable were the moments? I mean, I have of course seen it, but it has been years.
The only moment that I can recall being questionable, and it's really not questionable, it's just outright objectionable, is in a moment when the plane seems to be going down and everybody's screaming for no reason at all, a topless woman runs through the screen, also screaming and jiggling. Very funny moment for the adults, a little bit embarrassing for the children.
I think my daughter would get a little embarrassed about that. I mean,
how old is she?
She's 8.5, but she's very sensitive.
She'll be fine.
She's very sensitive to that type of stuff. Like, she will come home and tell me the kids.
Has she started developing yet?
I think a little bit, actually. I'm not sure. I can't tell,
it might be good for her to see what's in store.
Right. Yeah, I guess. I mean, She does come home from school and will tell on people who told her inappropriate things or used inappropriate language.
You know, I think she might get a real kick out of it. I would encourage you and the whole family to sit down and enjoy Airplane this weekend and have some fun with this false flag operation that's been going on for the past couple of weeks. Just, you know, there's a lighter side to the aviation industry that I don't think gets enough credit. And Airplane does a great job of really showing everybody the lighthearted moments and the fun that we have.
You know, I got to say, I thought you were going to recommend Alive to watch with my children. I don't know if you remember that one. That was about the...
That's about the soccer team that crashes in the Andes Mountains and resorts to cannibalism immediately.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I mean, I think Airplane is arguably more appropriate. I will let you know how my daughter reacts to it. But Michael?
Yeah, I'm here.
But thank you so much for coming on today and recommending this and sharing your theory with us about the plane. I mean, I think there's something to this, and hopefully somebody will pick up this ball and run with it.
Yeah, you're so welcome, Sam. If I can shed just a little bit of light on the situation, if I can make the world just a little bit better, if I can shine some illumination into the darkest corners of our media, our lamestream media, then I feel like I've done my job for the day. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, take the rest of the day off, because I think you have done your job for the day. Michael Ian Black, folks, thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks.
I just love what you said. You said, like, well, I don't take care of my family as well as you do, and he just went right.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't connect Airplane to the overall theme at first. It didn't really hit at first.
Oh, yeah. No, he said.
No, when he mentioned it, yes. Then I went, wow.
Now, we're not doing a Freebie Friday today, but I think we should have ended it a little bit earlier even. So maybe we'll retro. No Freebie Friday today. You know what? Yeah, Michael, that means extra cutting today. Let's play. Do we have a song from Jimmy Reeves?
There's a strategy involved to not cutting the material for the freebies. No, there's not a Jimmy Reeves Cake song. No.
No?
There is? Oh, gee.
You didn't even look. All right, I guess I'll...
I didn't see it. I did look.
Should I try and play it?
You got it?
Well, I can...
I mean, I could grab it, too.
Let's... yeah, I can't...
Why don't you tell Freebies how to become members and such, and I'll have the song ready to go.
Freebies, become a member at majority.fm. It is your membership that keeps this show alive and will help it grow. So become a member today. You can also buy your junk. If you buy Amazon junk, or junk from Amazon, I should say, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy your Amazon junk from there. We get a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Do we have that song?
And we've got it. This is Jimmy Reefer Cakes. It's a Bob Dylan cover of North Country Blues.
Mm. Well, we're not going to play the whole thing, but we'll play a minute of it. What? Go.
Come gather round, friends, and I'll tell you a tale. When the red iron ore pits ran aplenty, but the cardboard filled windows and old men on the benches tell you now that the whole town is empty. The north end of town, my own children are grown, but I was raised on the other. In the wee hours of youth, my mother took sick, and I was brought up by my brother. the iron ore poured as the years passed the door. The drag lines and shovels they was humming, till one day my brother failed to come home, the same as my father before him. With the long winter's weight from the window I watched, my friends they couldn't have been kinder, and my school it was cut and I quit in the spring.
All right, it's pretty good. I mean, it's a little bit of a downer at the end of the week, but I like that song. Jimmy Reefercake, you can always check out the Jimmy Reefercake at allthehypocrisy.com. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the funner half of the program. We got that Bill Donahue story and that interview with Alan Simpson, just too precious. We'll, of course, take your phone call, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. And the IM is Majority FM. See you in the funner half.